Welcome, Solaris subscribers. Here's Harry Blaser, and I have a very special guest tonight, Mr. Hugo de Garis. And probably a lot of you are not familiar with who this person is, but by the end of this conversation, I think you will be. So, Mr. de Garis, who are you? What have you done in your life? Why are you special?
Okay. I guess I'm best known for being the guy who's predicting a major war that I call the Utterlect War over the issue of what I call species dominance. And by dominance, I mean the most intelligent species. So the issue is whether humanity should or should not build godlike, massively intelligent machines that I call Utterlects, hence the Utterlect War. The word Utterlect is short for artificial intellect. So a godlike machine that would have mental capacities not like two times smarter than human beings or 10 times, but something like trillions of times above the human mental processing level. And these huge numbers come out of physics. There's a branch of computer science called PhysComp, which is physics of computation. Now, by background, I'm a pure math, physics, and computer science guy. Before I retired, I've been retired 8 years now. I was a computer science professor teaching that sort of stuff, and my research area was artificial brains. At the time, I was building China's first artificial brain. I still live in China, but in 2 months I will leave and I will migrate to Australia, where my family is. My sister has very generously set me up with a nice little one-person apartment in Melbourne, Australia, so I will leave China. I've been here 12 years. I was hoping to see China democratize, but it hasn't happened. And probably have to wait another decade or so. I've lived in 7 countries, so I'll just quickly go through the list. I grew up in Australia. I don't know, are you hearing more a British accent or an Aussie accent or a real mix, or are you hearing some American? Because I've lived in 3 English-speaking countries.
It's a nice mix.
A mix. Okay. I've lived in 3 English-speaking countries. So I grew up in Australia. My second country was England. So I lived there long enough to take out British citizenship. So I'm a dual citizen. And the third one, quite a few decades later, was the U.S. So I've lived 5 years in the U.S., in Utah, of all places, just because I got a professor job there. And the other 4 countries, well, I'll just give them in order. So Australia, England, Holland, Belgium, where I picked up French and German languages, Japan, America, China. So 5 years in America, 8 years in China, about 20-odd years in Europe, and the first 23 years in Australia, where I grew up. So I'm a math, physics, computer guy, and now I label myself an ARCR, that's A-R-C, that's After Retirement Career. People are so health conscious now, they're living into their 80s. I read recently that the average Australian male now has a life expectancy in the 80s. So I also read, which I found fascinating, there are boroughs in New York. For example, one borough, low class, low IQ, not health conscious, eats junk food, get junk bodies, and they die in their 60s, with a life expectancy in the 60s. There are other boroughs, upper middle class, professional, very health conscious, exercise, eat green vegetables and fruits, and their life expectancy is into the 90s. Now, I expect to go the same way. I'm very health conscious. My father is still alive, and he's 99. So I'm hoping over the next 30 years, because I'm now almost 71, so you've been retired 8 years, I'm expecting to get to 100. So over the next 30 years, I need another career, right? And then there are millions of people in similar situations. So I label these sort of people ARCRs, After Retirement Careering. And for me, my arcing is globication. I like putting two words together. So globication is just short for global education. And what I'm trying to do is to teach pure math, physics, and computer theory to PhD-level students around the world for free. And I do that in two ways. One is by making YouTube lecture courses, you know, whole courses, not just one lecture, but a whole series, about 125 of them over the next 30 years. That's one thing. And the second thing is I make electronic libraries. Google is putting up links to the whole book. You can read the whole book. And they're doing this with so many millions of books now that I'm able to, on a particular topic, give the link to these books. So that enables students around the world who are interested in a particular topic to open up a textbook on their screen, and then they can just teach themselves. So combined with these e-libraries and my YouTube lecture courses, students can teach themselves pure math, math physics, and computer theory at master's and PhD level for free. And that's a revolution. I'm hoping within 5 years or so, I may have as many as a million students around the world at this level teaching themselves for free. So that's sort of what I do. Before retirement, I was building China's first artificial brain. And what I was doing was evolving. So I was using sort of Darwinian methods in software and hardware. And people call me the father of evolvable hardware, EH. So I'd evolved neural networks in electronics at electronic speeds. So I could evolve these neural networks in about a second or so because they were so fast. So I could evolve tens of thousands of them and then connect them up in humanly designed ways. So I was a kind of BA, a brain architect. So I was designing brains, and I could evolve each little circuit, each little brick, each component of the brain in special electronics at electronic speeds. So I was hoping then to persuade the president of my university to make the city we both lived in, Xiamen. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's not far from Hong Kong. And I rather inadvisedly remarked to this president, look, it would be nice to have lots of foreign Western professors come and build up China's artificial brain industry, but they probably won't come because they know about Mao Zedong and the 80 million people he killed. And then I get an email back from him saying, you've broken the law. And then 2 months later, my contract is not renewed. So I got into forced retirement. I was politically fired and blacklisted then from ever getting another government university job in China. So in that sense, I have an utter hatred of the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP.
And how long ago was that?
That was 8 years ago. So I went into forced retirement. Now, I had enough savings from my pension fund when I was a prof in Utah in the U.S., because the cost of living in China is about, sixth of what it is in the U.S. So that savings I had from the U.S. professorial pension fund went about five times further in China than it would in the U.S. So it dawned on me, hey, I could afford to retire. So I did. I now have a Chinese green card. So I have the option to stay here for another 10 years if I want, but I don't want. I'm fed up. What's really driving me out of the country is the very slow internet speed. It's just painful. So I have to use a VPN that allows you to go around the censorship of the Chinese government, which bans Facebook, YouTube, major sites like that, particularly YouTube. They don't want all this. They don't want people saying the sort of things I'm saying about the Chinese government, which has killed over 80 million of its own citizens. Is that enough of background?
Oh, fantastic! You did a great job. So, let me ask this now: why China? I mean, you couldn't find people interested in the United States to have you build an artificial brain in some of these other places?
Good question. I ask myself the same question quite often. There are probably several answers. If you meet anybody who has lived in seven countries, they would have to be a bit of a cultural adventurer, right? So I guess that's the first thing. It's just my personality. I enjoy the novelty of a new culture. You know, you learn so much. Everything's so different. I love novelty. So that's one. Two, jobs. I just went where the jobs were. And my brain building was so specialized. I just went where I could get a job. Like in America, I went to Utah, of all places, with the Mormons. So I felt like a tropical bird amongst penguins. But I went there because I got a job there as a prof. So why China? Well, that was the country after America. And I did not appreciate at all the high, almost suffocating level of religiosity in Utah. So I was glad to get out because the Chinese offered me, they gave me a fantastic offer. So that was a big kick in the positive sense. And they gave me a whole lab and lots of students. It was just a wonderful deal until I started learning the downside, and that is the students themselves. The Chinese, they're just not very creative. Chinese have literally won science homegrown Nobel Prize. So, I became somewhat disillusioned. I mean, the money was great, had lots of people, but no quality, no real creativity. So it was very much a mixed bag.
Let me ask you this. In your book, and that was written in 2005, correct?
No, this was published. It was written literally 20 years ago in 98. I was staying at a friend's house in New Jersey. So it's 20 years old.
Okay, so in that book, you talk about a number of ventures that didn't quite meet your goals and expectations when it came to building an artificial brain. Can you spend a little time about what happened? Because your approach was quite novel, and also a lot of folks thought, it may not work that well. So I want to know if you still believe that approach is the right approach, and then just a little bit about, okay, well, what didn't work quite as well as you expected?
So from 2001 to 2006, so those were the 5 years I was in the U.S. Now, a few years before that, when I was in Japan, the Japanese gave me about $250,000 to build an artificial brain evolving machine. So this was a machine that could evolve neural networks very, very fast. And the guy who actually built them was a Russian-American based in Boulder, Colorado. He built four or five of these. He kept one or two for himself, and one was sold to the Japanese lab I was at, and so on. And this was like late 90s. By then, it was becoming clear that Japan had stagnated. The bubble, the property bubble in Japan had burst, and the stock market had crashed, and Japan just went into deep recession. And just never, even today, it hasn't. Has not pulled itself out of it. So the lab I was at, which was a private Japanese company you probably heard of, NTT, they funded the lab, but they thought they weren't getting their money's worth, so they just axed major portions of the lab. So that was the end of my stay in Japan. So anyway, so the machine was there. It was called Star Lab, so supposedly a laboratory of stars. So we had a rather famous Russian guy who was into time travel. He was a mathematician talking about traveling in time. I was the brain builder and various other weird people. But the lab was housed in two different buildings. And in the first one, something wrong with the electricity. So the machine didn't function properly. And so the CEO of the research lab was unwilling to pay. And so there's this bitter dispute between the Russian builder and the CEO of the lab. And so eventually that lab went bankrupt because given the timing, 2001, 2002, so that was the dot-com crash. So then I went to America. I couldn't get people to buy one because it was expensive. These machines were about $500,000 each. I feel a bit jinxed.
Okay, so let me ask this question. This machine, was it making networks on a chip Or was it making chips of networks? What did it do exactly?
It had programmable hardware so that you could evolve neural networks in hardware, simulated neural networks in hardware. You could program the chips, these programmable chips, so that they behave like evolvable neural networks. And they were evolving these neural networks incredibly fast, like, you know, a matter of seconds. So that made it possible to evolve large numbers of them. But because of the dispute between the boss of the lab and my Russian manufacturer, the Russian manufacturer had access to the machine, you know, because it was his design, and he just cut it off. He just made it so it couldn't function. That was his lever to be paid. Because, you know, his financial survival, given $500,000 per machine, depended on him getting paid, which eventually he didn't, because the CEO could not, because he went bankrupt thanks to the dot-com crash. You know, investors just stopped investing in the lab.
So let me ask you this. The human brain, would you describe it in terms of numbers of neural networks, in terms of numbers of neurons, in terms of synapses or connections? How would you describe the human brain?
Okay, I'll give you some rough numbers. The male brain, human brain, has roughly about 100 billion, that's 10 to power 11, brain cells or neurons. And roughly each neuron connects to about 10,000 others. And each connection is known as a synapse, that's the biological term, and each synapse can signal, send bits per second, at roughly about 10 bits per second. So the computing capacity of the human brain is estimated at about, well, you just multiply those three numbers, so how many neurons, 10 to the 11, how many connections per neuron, well, about 10,000, so it's 10 to the 4, so it's 10 to the 15 if you multiply those two numbers. And each synapse, each connection, is signaling roughly at about 10 bits per second. So that's another 10 to the 1. So you come out with 10 to the 16. Now, one of the things that really got me alarmed was, you've probably heard of nanotech. So if you take just a single grain of sand and you nanotech it in such a way that each atom in that grain of sand is manipulating one bit, what would the processing capacity of that single grain of sand, nanotech, be? Well, it's the back of an envelope type calculation. You can work out roughly how many atoms would be in that cubic millimeter. And each atom can switch, back and forth, 0, 1, 0, 1, in a femtosecond. That's a thousandth of a trillionth. That's a thousandth of a millionth of a millionth of a second. And so you can work out how many bit flips that single grain of sand can bit flip per second. Then compare that number with the bit processing rate estimated of the human brain, which was 10 to power 16. So it worked out that that little grain of sand can outperform the human brain by a factor of a quintillion. That's a million trillion times more than the human brain. So that for me was the writing on the wall. All the rest, how humanity builds these godlike, massively intelligent machines, that's all just details. Right? The essence, the core idea, is that humanity now has the technological capacity to build what I call artelects, artificial intellects, these godlike, massively intelligent machines. So I see the 21st century's global politics being dominated by this issue of what I call species dominance. Should humanity build or not build these godlike, massively intelligent machines, these artelects? And I see humanity splitting over the issue. It's an extremely divisive issue with very powerful arguments, both sides of the argument. So I'll bring in some labels now, because I'll be talking about the two major schools of thought, two major philosophies on this question. So those people in favor who want to build these godlike machines, I call them cosmists. That's based on the word cosmos, obviously. You know, in other words, the universe, because that's their perspective. You know, they see the big picture, you know, the whole universe. And there are stars out there billions of years older than our sun. So probably you know, life is commonplace throughout the universe. So probably there are civilizations that are billions of years older than we are who have been through this process of moving on beyond biology to the artelect. So maybe this transition from biology to the artelect has happened zillions of times. Maybe it's just a very common occurrence in the universe. So a label then, cosmists, based on the word cosmos. And the other group are labeled Terrans. That's T-E-R-R-A, the Earth, Terra. And their main philosophy is that building these godlike machines, these artelects, is risky. It's too dangerous because they could become so vastly superior to human beings that who knows, maybe one day they'll just say, well, you know, these human beings, they're a pest. They're so inferior to us. And they're a liability because they need oxygen, and the oxygen is rusting our circuitry, or you know, something like that. And so they just decide to get rid of us. And being hyper-intelligent, they could do that very easily, the way we humans control the lives of cows and chickens and so forth. So the Terrans will say humanity must never build these artelects, because if it does, then humanity faces the risk of our own extermination. I put the issue of species dominance in the form of a slogan that makes it easy for people to remember. And it goes as follows. Do we build gods, or do we build our potential exterminators? Which would be the Terran point of view. So the main motive from the point of view of the cosmists is that they would be god-building, creating the next rung on the ladder of evolution, seeing human beings as a kind of stepping stone towards the creation of a vastly superior creature, the artelect, that would not even be biological. It would be artelectual, so technology with hugely superior capacities for mental processing. And the other group, the Terrans, they're terrified at the potential risk of extermination. So I'm predicting a major war over this issue. And I call the war, obviously, the Artelect War. Now, 20th century wars, you know, World War I, World War II, and so on, were essentially between nation states. But a major 21st century war, say middle to second half of the 21st century, that would be a global war. It'd be the whole planet, because the size of political units keeps increasing over time. But there's a limit to that process. Eventually you get a unit that's the size of the whole planet. And you're talking 21st century weaponry. You're far more deadly and efficient than 20th century weapons. So if there's a major war, and by major I mean extremely passionate, because you know, what are we talking about this time? We're not talking about the survival of a country. Now we're talking about the survival of a species. In other words, us, human beings. People will passionately take sides. On the one hand, you'll have the cosmists who want to build gods. They'll be making outrageous statements like saying one artelect is worth a trillion human beings, you know, this sort of stuff, which will utterly terrify the Terrans, saying that, you know, these cosmists are monsters, so they have to be exterminated for the sake of the survival of billions of human beings. So they'll see it justified to exterminate several million cosmists for the sake of the survival of the billions, you know, the large majority of human beings. So they'll be at each other's throats. Now, the tragedy of the situation, as I see it, is that it's very difficult to build an artificial brain, because to be able to do that, we need to know how our human brain works. But the human brain is the most complicated thing in the known human universe. Right, it's it's fantastically complicated. So it will take time for brain science to understand how it works, to be able to build a genuinely intelligent machine. You know, we're making progress, but it will not be an overnight thing, I strongly suspect, because it'll be step by step, incremental progress as humanity builds better tools to understand how the brain works and so forth. So in other words, there will be lots of time for this species dominance debate to unfold. I talk about various phases, in other words, stages of development in this species dominance debate. So phase zero is just no awareness. Nobody on the planet is aware of the possibility that these machines may become vastly more intelligent than human beings and hence become a potential threat, an existential threat to humanity. Phase one is the intellectuals crying in the wilderness phase. And that's where I felt I was in the 90s. There's just a handful of us worried about this issue. Phase two is interest groups. For example, on the internet, you know, thousands of people talking about the issues in forums and that kind of thing. Phase three, which a few years ago I think was entered, and that's what I call mainstream. Particularly the media, the media gets interested in the issue and starts writing about it and putting on documentaries and television and so forth. In other words, presenting these ideas of species dominance to the masses. And phase four, which we're entering now a bit, phase four is simply politics. People start getting politically active, talking about the issue and going to the United Nations and that sort of thing. And I suppose phase five, which hasn't happened yet, would be the war itself. Now, the war itself, if it comes to that, given 21st century weaponry and the level of passion involved, so people will be fighting for the very survival of the human species on the one hand and wanting to build gods to go out into the whole universe, the much bigger picture than puny little humanity that which has a life expectancy snuffed out in a pathetic 80 years in a universe billions of years old. You can get the picture, right? You have extremely powerful arguments, both sides of the debate. And things are a bit complicated in the sense that there's a third group, and they're the people who compromise. They're the people who want to become artelects themselves. They're called cyborgs or cyborgists. They're the people who want to add components to their own brains and become, bit by bit, there's a pun intended there, artelects themselves. So they would convert themselves from humans to artelects. But from the point of view of the Terrans, these cyborgists aren't very different from just the pure machine. Because, well, here's another interesting little story. Go, 20, 30, 40 years into the future. And imagine you're a young woman and you've just given birth to your first child. And the technology exists to cyborg your child, if you want, because it's all around you. People are cyborging themselves left and right. It's just part of the culture. It's in the air, imagine. So let's say this young woman, this young mother, decides to cyborg her child. So she goes to some company which inserts a grain of sand that's been nanotech'd into the baby's brain. And this little piece of nanotech miracle can outperform the human brain by a factor of a quintillion, remember, a million trillion times more. So effectively, it dawns on the mother after a while that she has killed her baby. I mean, it still looks like a baby, but in terms of mental capacity, that brain with the added grain of nanotech sand, it's 99.99999% artelect, right? And only 0.00001% human. So effectively, that baby is no longer human. And in terms of its behavior, that baby, so-called, of hers, relative to her as a human, is totally alien, utterly alien. And these Terrans are feeling that their very existence is being threatened by the presence of the growing intelligence level of the cyborgs and the machines themselves, just as their own home robots, for example. A huge industry within, I don't know, 10, 15 years from now, probably. As the machine intelligence level and the human intelligence level, as that IQ gap closes, as millions, if not billions of people see with their own eyes that their own home robots are getting smarter and smarter every year, I expect, almost certainly, to see the species dominance debate really heat up as phase four, you know, politics really gets going. So I expect to see that. But I doubt I will still be alive for the war. Yeah, the whole process will take time to unfold.
So now, Hugo, you have well established your interest, credentials, and understanding of this whole issue. And I want to use this opportunity, and we may have to do this in two parts because you're a fascinating person. And by saying what you have, you've stimulated a lot of questions. So I want to ask some questions that are important to me and I think our listeners. Is basically building neural networks enough to create a brain and to create intelligence? I mean, it almost seems like the premise is get something with enough ability to communicate with itself and intelligence emerges out of that connectivity. Is that a premise?
That's a really good question. And it's a question that dominates the intelligists, in other words, the people who build artificial intelligence. My best friend, you may have heard the name. His name is Ben Goertzel. You heard the name?
Yes, I have.
Okay, he is the father of AGI. It's his term, which stands for Artificial General Intelligence. Like, today's AI is largely very narrow-focused. It's very specific, like Google, you know, search.
Yeah, the AGI is like, kind of like the philosopher's stone of artificial intelligence, right? If you can get machines to do that. Yeah, so definitely talk about that. That's great.
Okay. All right. Well, Ben and I, we're very good friends, and yet we differ in basic philosophy on how to approach this. So there are two very broad approaches. One is, it's almost common sense, one is copy the brain, right? If you copy the brain closely enough, sooner or later you will end up with a machine that functions according to biological human brain principles, right? So that's the one approach, copy the brain. And the other approach is what I simply call the engineering approach. In other words, do whatever you like. Right? Any idea you have, you just engineer it. And that's Ben Goertzel's approach. Firstly, he's a genius. I mean, he's literally a genius. He has an IQ of 186, right? Not many people on the planet at that level, so he's a genius.
Yeah, so isn't the whole idea here that, like, one school, like you said, has built something like the brain and will end up being intelligent, and the other is just think about the goals that you want to try to accomplish and engineer to that, and that will get you there. Is that basically it?
Right. Now, both approaches are being taken by the intelligists, the brain builders, because no one's sure which way will work out. Now, there are cynics both ways. One, the cynics of towards the copy the brain approach is that the brain's so complicated. You know, we don't understand how the brain works. We don't even have the basic principles. Like, what is a memory? What is a thought? How is a decision made? You know, basic questions that little kids can pose. Still don't really have answers yet in neuroscience.
So let me just quote a couple things, which I think you agree with. This was said by Dr. James Giordano. I don't know if you know him, at a Lawrence Livermore seminar. And he says, we still don't understand how does the great stuff, like cognition, emotion, behavior, arise from the gray stuff, which is our brain. And he says, we don't understand what the efficient cause is of what the brain does. Or another way he said it is, how does brain make mind? So I think you would agree with those statements, right? that we don't know that right now.
Yeah, I mean, well, one of my interests is philosophy. You may have heard of the so-called hard problem. By putting atoms together, molecules together, how on earth do you create consciousness? You know, what is consciousness?
Exactly, exactly.
So you've got a major problem here. So the brain builders who copy the brain have their work cut out for them. On the other hand, the engineering approach, well, that's the approach that's been taken for the, well, when did AI get going? Mid-60s. I think the very first artificial intelligence conference was held in 56. So it's been around for, 60, 70 years. And people have been taking the engineering approach of necessity because, you know, in those days, very little was known about the brain. And obviously unsuccessfully, because today we still do not have intelligent machines. So people don't really know which of the two major approaches will pan out. So both are being tried. Now, my approach, I guess, was a bit of a mix. I was using neural networks. I was modeling how biological neural networks work, and I was using evolutionary or evolvable hardware, evolutionary engineering. So you're building things by evolving them very fast. And I was reading lots of neuroscience to try to get ideas on brain architectures, because I consider myself the first BA, brain architect. And that technology is still yet to be developed. I imagine in the future, you know, a decade from now, there will be a new job category of people who label themselves BAs. I anticipate countries, governments, will set up ABAs, that's ABA, Artificial Brain Administrations. And by administrate, I mean like NASA, what's that, National Aeronautic and Space Administration. And by administration, you're talking tens of thousands of engineers and scientists. Like for NASA, their job is to design rockets and so forth to go out into the planets and explore them. One of the things I tried to convince the president of my university to help me set up was something I called a CABA, so the Chinese Artificial Brain Administration. So there will be severe competition amongst various countries to build ever-increasingly intelligent artificial brains, because this industry will be enormous. Because imagine you could buy a home robot that was genuinely useful, like it could walk the dog, it could tell you stories, it could wash the dishes, the clothes, clean the house, amuse you, sex you, educate you. It could do all those things. And then ask yourself, how much money would you be prepared to spend to buy such a robot? And if you ask people, most people will say, well, maybe more than for a car. And probably not as much as for a house. That's usually your biggest expense. But more than a car. And since nearly everyone would want to buy one, you're talking a huge industry. So, the governments will obviously get involved. They will invest heavily in setting up these artificial brain administrations to foster the whole process, you know, paying the salaries of thousands of engineers. And as a result of that, each year, the intelligence level of these home robots, or the artificial brains that control them, will, of course, keep rising so that the IQ gap, you know, between human-level intelligence and machine-level intelligence, that gap will keep diminishing, and hence the species dominance debate will heat up and up and up. So I'm predicting this species dominance debate will become the dominant issue, the dominant political phenomenon of our century, eventually leading to a major war, because the passion level on either side, you know, building gods on the one hand, and building potential exterminators on the other. So I'm very gloomy. I'm just the only positive thing for me is, you know, given my age, now that I'm in my 70s, I will not see it, very probably. I will not see the war. But I do expect to see the debate really heat up.
Okay, so now I want to ask this important question, because we don't really know how the brain works. We don't know which approach or a combination of those two approaches might get us to creating an artificial brain, but yet you feel very confident that we'll get there. What gives you that level of confidence? Is it a version of Moore's Law, just the exponential growth in processing and knowledge? Is it the progress in neurobiology that'll give us architecture of the brain and much better understanding of it? What gives you that confidence we're going to get there?
All of the above, with the two main things you said, so you know, the effect of Moore's Law. In fact, humanity has already reached human brain processing levels of about 10 to power 16 bit flips a second. Technology has already reached that level. So all that remains is the other part, the bioscience knowledge level. We still don't understand how the brain works yet. Now, Moore's Law feeds into neuroscience as well, because the neuroscientists are given increasingly powerful tools, you know, nanotech-based tools to understand how the brain works. And so progress in understanding how the brain works is exponential. It's just skyrocketing lately. So the brain architects, these engineers who build artificial brains, they already have more electronics than they know what to do with. So that does not limit them now. What's still limiting them is the ideas, you know, what to build, how to build it, this kind of thing. But they're being stimulated strongly by rapid progress in neuroscience. So I see a kind of wedding between nanotechnology on the one hand and neuroscience on the other, an extremely powerful wedding between these two, showing initially, the scientists, the brain builders themselves, just how powerful this wedding between these two will be. And in time, the whole public will become conscious as they see for themselves.
Would you agree with this, that there's kind of two underlying premises to all this? One is that digital computers can simulate any process of formal reasoning, because basically formal reasoning has been shown to be able to be described mathematically. And human intelligence can be so precisely described that a machine can be made to simulate it.
Is your background philosophy by any chance? What is your background?
Well, as a matter of fact, I did study philosophy for 3 years at Brandeis before I went into a music career. But this is a very important answer from you.
Yeah. I guess as a working hypothesis, I'd say yes to both of those. Philosophy is a hobby of mine. I enjoy reading it very much. My first wife took a philosophy degree. So I'm not philosophical naive. If you're going to be an engineer and build stuff, you have to believe that what you're doing is not a complete waste of time. Although I'm still, like, if you ask me what's the solution towards the hard problem, I readily admit that I don't even have the conceptual tools to even begin to think about how to solve that problem.
Okay, so now I want to keep going in this vein, because you're an incredible resource to help brainstorm this. So part of this is assuming that there is a direct analogy between intelligence and computational capabilities. So it's almost like these guys, and perhaps yourself, are looking at intelligence as fundamentally computational, the ability to do computations very quickly and analyze all kind of data to find patterns, which is another form of computation, you might say. So one of the things that I found a little bit disturbing in your book was the way that you talked about ants and other things and said, you know, these things are stupid. And the Adelexu look at humans as being stupid. So I got to tell you, I don't look at an ant as stupid. I look at it, given what it is, it does absolutely astonishing things beyond what humans are actually capable of. I look at my dog and go, this guy ain't stupid. I probably have a very poor understanding of my dog. You know, I got some basic understanding of it. It'll do this for food. I can put on a leash. It lets me know when it wants to poop. It likes to play with my frisbee. But in terms of how its brain works, it looks at the world, how it figures out things, how it decides when it wants to bark and what it wants to tell me by barking. You know, I don't have much of a clue at all about these things. So one of my concerns is that there's an arrogance among the scientific community because they've had so much success at digitizing things. But one of the ways that we're going to end up in like a circle where they say, see, I told you so, is they're going to look at everything as digitizable, but it ain't. And they're going to turn the world into a model that allows them to create success. But in the process, they're going to make it deformed, but also incredibly enervated. It's not going to have the same energy, the same feel, the same capability, because there's things beyond computation, beyond digitization. So I'd like you to react to that.
This reminds me of a debate I had once with, it was on TV, in fact, in London. The year 2000, I think. You've probably heard of the name Sir Roger Penrose.
Oh, yes. A very famous physicist out of the UK.
Yeah, very famous, yes. I think he's the smartest person I've ever ever come across. And he was saying, yeah, but your approach is purely computational. And he's getting into Gödel theorem. And
sure.
Sir Roger Penrose, his IQ is estimated around 210 or something. So he was complaining bitterly that my approach seemed to be largely computational. And so my reply to him, this may be a reply to you as well, my underlying assumption is that we as human beings, we are living examples of the idea that it's possible to build creatures, you know, three-dimensional living creatures that are intelligent and conscious, because we are built in the embryogenic process. You know, in the embryo is a self-assembling DNA controlled self-assembly process. We're built. So this DNA controls how molecules are put together to build an intelligent, conscious creature. I guess that's one of my basic premises. We're built. And physics and chemistry understands, well, pretty well, how, you know, how this process works. And I'm discovering more all the time how the embryogenic process works. So that, I guess, is pretty much an article of faith. But it seems to be borne out over time because embryogenesis is better and better understood every year. So I guess that's my basic philosophical principle, is that we're built, things that can be built, understandable, and it's only a question of time before humanity and the scientists understand enough to do something similar, to just, well, I guess, imitate the brain well enough to be able to do it artificially. Now, relatively, if you can do that, where's the limit? I mean, how big, for example, could you have a computational device with all the latest technologies, you know, three-dimensional circuitry, quantum computing, reversible computing, at zero temperature, incredibly fast computing device the size of asteroids, with brain volume a zillion times larger than human brain, so smart that it bootstraps itself into higher and higher levels of intelligence, finds new ways to be intelligent, so redesigns itself to be based on that new way and ratchet itself up to the point of it being godlike. So that possibility I find fascinating. But on the other hand, when I'm in the park and I'm looking at all these little Chinese kids, really cute when they're small, and I think, my God, if there's going to be an Artelect war and billions of people will be killed, then all these people, including myself, will be evaporated. And so I find that utterly depressing. So I'm extremely ambivalent about this.
Okay, so now we're at another crucial point here, because in a way, this is all about dealing with risk, and humans have always wanted to reduce risk, increase predictability. And in a way, biology has dealt with that through adaptation. And now we're at the point where we're dealing it more and more through engineering. And you talked about building. Well, I think there's a difference between building a machine and biology building a human. And if we don't understand that difference, I mean, people talk about souls and these other things. I'm not trying to go there. But all I'm trying to say is there's something that we don't understand, that math can't get you there. Traditional science, reductionist science can't get you there. That's another component of life. My concern is that AI will be successful, and it's increasingly successful. And not so much even that humans will be wiped out as a species potentially in this war that you're talking about, which I think is very possible, but the human nature will be wiped out and made more and more machine-like. That's what will happen through this thing, and that's why I was very interested in talking with you to see if you do you give any credence to what I just said. Do you think it's just I'm being a Luddite, you know, as they love to say about people that make those types of arguments? What would be your reaction to that?
Well, I'm sort of both. There are times, a couple of years back, I had the equivalent of an atlas for countries, but they were for star systems and galaxies. So I'd turn the page and I'd see these glossy, rich colored photographs of galaxies and so forth. And I'd look at each little white dot in the photograph and say, my God, that's a star. That each little white dot, there's like hundreds of billions of stars in a galaxy typically. And let's say that pretty well each one of these white dots had a planetary system, and probably life is very common, so at least bacteria all over the cosmos. So when I'm thinking in that mode, I think cosmist. I'd say, yes, humanity must go to this stage. We have to do it. And then, on the other hand, sometimes I'll wake up after a nightmare. The horrors of the Arctic War itself, and with passion on both sides, and 21st century weapons, billions of people being killed. I call it giga death. So it's just absolutely horrible. So I'm very, very torn. Now, interestingly, the last couple of years, I've been taking opinion polls on a small scale. Like, I'll give a talk somewhere, and different kinds of audiences, and I'll invite them to talk. For example, next
50-50, right? 50-50.
Well,
I bet
initially yes. Initially, with sort of general audiences, I was getting typically between 40% and 60% either way. I'd ask them to choose between two. Are you more Terran or are you more cosmist, to keep it simple? And it would vary between 40-60 and 60-40. Just a couple of years ago, I got to talk to a bunch of very young, say 20-year-old Chinese computer science students. I thought, now these guys are much more informed about the latest in computer technology and so forth. I wonder if that would have an influence. And the answer was yes. The highest I've ever had in favor of cosmism was 80%. Now, interestingly, in mid-September, I will be flown to Missouri to give a plenary session talk to the mostly religionists, the Christians. So I'm very curious to see what percentage. You start asking questions, as a sociologist, you start asking questions, well, when this species dominance debate really heats up, when it really gets going and becomes the dominant issue of our times, then obviously the psychologists and the sociologists, the social science guys, will have to get in on the act, because it's just so important, so big. So from a sociologist's point of view, you can imagine them asking questions like, is there a correlation between the level of religiosity of people and them being more Terran? Is there an age difference? Is there a generation difference? Like older people, are they more likely to be Terran than Cosmist? Is there a correlation with intelligence? The higher IQ people, would they more likely be Cosmist? Gender, is there a male-female difference? And this sort of thing. So I call this new, well, it doesn't exist yet, but potentially a new branch of sociology called simply Artelect sociology, you know, that asks all these questions. And in time, governments will become interested because you know, they'll be making policy statements on these issues. So they would like to know what the general public feels about them. So they will be commissioning surveys on these issues. So I'm just trying to get the ball rolling on this.
I think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating, this 80% number that you got. I will tell you, I was sitting at a software and hardware development company in China a number of years ago because a guy asked me to go over there and help him out on something. And I guess I brought up the issue of the 30 or 40 million, which you claim is 80 at that time. That was the number being tossed around. It probably was closer to 80 million people that Mao got rid of. And what I noticed was that it's basically younger people and young adults that were in the room, and there was one older guy, and they explained to me, yeah, when about 50 years old, you know, you're kind of put out the pasture in China to make room for the new people, with a few exceptions. But this younger guy said, well, sometimes you just have to clean out that many people to just make things, you know, work.
Oh, my God.
So without batting an eye, yes, which, you know, ties in a way to the Cosmist perspective on this thing that, yeah, humans are an ant in terms of the cosmos. So, you know, ants get stepped on and humans will get stepped on for a greater good. And, you know, this guy, you know, 30, 50, 80 million people got wiped out in China for the greater good. You've been very, very generous with your time. But if you can hang in just a little longer, I've got two or three other questions, and maybe we could do a second session.
Yeah, that's fine. Look, don't. I need to explain myself a bit. One of the reasons why I'm moving out of China is I live in a cultural cocoon. I'm actually afraid to get fluent in the language because I'm afraid that if I were fluent, I'd be too tempted to let fly my hatred of the party. So I've deliberately not got fluent for that reason. And oddly, when I do return to Australia, I will get fluent in Chinese. Because if I live another 30 years, almost certainly within that period, China will democratize. And once China democratizes and stops being so ultra-conservative, you know, it's the only country in the world that does not use an alphabet, this kind of thing. So I anticipate a flourishing of creativity in China with 1.4 billion people. Imagine a whole city of 10 million people where everyone has an IQ over 140. You know, they're in the top percentile. And China could create a science city like that if it wanted.
You know, Hugo, some of the stupidest people I've ever met are some of the highest IQ people I've ever met.
Okay. Yeah, so they can do
so
math.
Right, there you go. They could do math, all right. So let me ask you these couple things. Is it possible for AI to be irrational or illogical?
Oh God! Now you're asking me Gödel type questions. That's a really tough question. I think I'll pass.
Okay. Well, then let me ask you this one. What is intelligence? Because we're talking about IQs, which is supposedly measuring intelligence. We're talking about brains that are going to be super intelligent.
Yeah.
So what is intelligence? What's our goal?
Okay. I take a fairly common sense type approach to trying to answer that question. To me, intelligence is just the ability to solve problems quickly. like people who have higher IQs can do this faster than other people, and qualitatively they can solve some problems that dumber people can't even start to solve.
Wait. They can solve certain kinds of problems faster.
Yeah, but some people are just wiser. You know, they take in more variables, and when they consider how to you know, giving advice to people, and the abilities differ enormously this way, and you get these outliers. And
okay, so now, if intelligence, according to you, is the ability to solve problems quickly, is AI basically the ability of machines to solve problems efficiently?
Yeah, essentially that would be my basic view as an engineer, or well, I use the term intelligist, yeah, the person who does AI.
Okay, and then how is an AI-based computer or AI different than traditional computing, algorithm-based computing, or rule-based computing? Can you tell us something about that?
It depends how it's implemented. If you use like conventional software algorithms, that's one approach, and then that's the engineering approach. You just do whatever you like. Increasingly, though, computer components become more brain-like. They're being influenced by the way the brain functions with neural networks. IBM makes brain-like chips, puts them together and connects them up in brain-like ways. IBM talks about cognitive intelligence and cognitive technology. So what I was talking about before about the wedding between nanotech and brain science. So there are many AI teams, and they're taking a whole range of approaches, and no one really knows which approach will pan out faster. So people are on all fronts just trying what they think might work.
Is there any one thing that distinguishes AI from the type of computing that was done 30 or 20 or 40 years ago?
I suppose the brain-like aspect of it. 20, 30, 40, half a century ago, there was a pretty hard distinction between hardware and software. So you had the hard logic that didn't change, and you programmed it. So the instructions to program the hardware was called software. So you had this distinction. You could have different software instructions operating on the same piece of hardware. That's why it was called hard. It didn't change. It was fixed. But nowadays, with brain-like computing, the hardware-software distinction dies away. And the essential difference between the two is that with the brain approach, it's more the connectivity that's critical. So in our brains, when we learn something, we create new connections between brain cells, between neurons. In other words, new synapses. So synapses can get strengthened or weakened. That's what learning is. So I suppose the essence of AI is learning, right? Storing memories about previous experiences and then using them for the future, machine learning. So that's machine learning is becoming a critical part today in modern artificial intelligence, because there was a breakthrough in... sounds contradictory, but there are new algorithms for machine learning. You may have heard of it, deep learning.
Yep. Wasn't IBM the main driver for that?
I think it was one genius, the same guy who did back propagation. Heard of that? Back prop?
Yep.
It was the same guy, Hinton. So the reason why it's called deep learning is you can go deep into the network, many more layers of neurons, and you can use this new algorithm to change the strength of the connections in the neurons in these deeper layers.
Okay, so that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you. What is the connection between machine learning and AI?
Ah, well, they're sort of becoming the same. I don't really make a distinction nowadays, because machine learning is just like this. Since this new algorithm came out, it's just sweeping the field. It's just like everyone's taking it up, and They're virtually the same now.
Okay, so now let me create a scenario for you. I want your reaction to this. Because connectivity is so key.
Yeah, that's the way the brain works. It's essentially the connectivity between neurons that's critical.
Okay, so connectivity is key.
Yeah.
So now you've got a huge push for connectivity. You have a huge push for increasing processing power. You have huge amounts of storage. You have huge big data, the ability to analyze this. Now you're going to have the Internet of Things. On top of it, you've got neuroscience that's understanding more and more about how the brain functions. But already now, they admitted, because this talk at Livermore was about, let me tell you about the science of mind control and how we're able to do it. So what's much more likely to happen is not your Autolect war, but is that the people that are in control, you know, the people that like to be in control, the people that, you know, have a view of most humans as a problem rather than potential, will be able to use all of these tools to control behaviors. So there never will be a war. And not only that, you have incredible geniuses that are great at marketing, you know, like Steve Jobs, that people will be basically enslaving themselves.
You're talking about the Illuminati and all that?
No, I'm talking about AT&T and IBM and Facebook and all these guys that are already censoring, you know, what you look at. They're already looking at every search that you do so that they can customize their searches. And they're using AI right now to figure out how people behave and to sell more stuff. And then, you know, and you got the big push on 5G and you got the big push on Internet of Things. And it's corporations, the military, DARPA, everybody, just like you claim in your book, is pushing for these capabilities. The point is, who's in control of them? We don't even know our governance system. We don't know the governance system in the world. We don't know who's really the final decision makers and pushing for the decisions. We know that there's pedophilia rings. We know that there are control files on lots of people. But is it the intelligence agencies that ultimately have the say? Because we're not a democracy anymore.
Yeah, haven't been for a century.
Right. We're moving rapidly towards fascism. I mean, we never were a democracy. We were a representative form of government. But so all I'm saying is you have people that will be developing these tools, that will have the money to control these tools with the capability to shape behavior the way they want. There won't be a war. Because they'll be able to make it so people will just accept it or die. The ones that are real troublemakers, they will just kill them.
Yeah, well, you may be right. we're talking about the future, so it's always risky. What worries me, though, is there may be various tendencies moving along in parallel. What you've just portrayed may be one of them. But what I see happening is, well, likely to happen, is that once the IQ gap seriously starts closing, and millions, if not billions of people see that gap with their own eyes, they see it closing, and many people will become alarmed. And when the large majority of people really become alarmed, then the small elite that usually sends fear into their eyes.
So, no, but who's alarmed now that basically generations of kids are spending most of their lives in front of a cell phone, looking at it, texting? Yeah. They'll be at a dinner table and won't even be having a conversation except through this phone to either each other or other things. That's a form of AI taking over. See, from my perspective.
How will they react when their gadgets seriously start becoming intelligent?
But wait a minute. How do they react that, you know, a obviously false flag operation in 9/11 created a security state that enabled a level of surveillance that our forefathers warned us would lead to slavery. Okay? Well, who's reacting? Okay, there's a small portion of people that are reacting to that. But when you take a look at the amount of infringement of our rights, our constitutional rights, that's happened and since 2001, never mind before, it's like it's happening and people are enabling it. And if you said if you had to give up your cell phone in order to protect the Constitution, what do you think the answer would be? Right. So my concern is that this AI is here. And see, I also believe with the 20-something trillion dollars that we know has been misplaced, just from the Department of Defense and HUD. Where did that money go? How was it used? And, you know, when you talk to somebody like Bezos, he was asked, the $90 or $100 billion you're worth now, where does that money go? And he said, well, there's only one place I could ever rationalize putting it, and that's for space. So I believe that AI and mapping of the brain and lots of other things have been done already by the black organizations, you know, in this world that basically have used drugs, have used financial fraud and other things to take that money and get it's been described almost as a breakaway civilization. That's why when the guy that's head of Lockheed 30 years ago said we have the technology to bring ET home, was he just a lying, exaggerating, you know, crap head? No. What is he? That's why Fermi's whole premise, you know, about, yeah. Well, how, you know, right, is bullshit. We have gigantic amounts of evidence about ETs. Gigantic. Every way you look, there's evidence of it, okay? And Fermi should know from the guys that he associated with who know about the damn ETs, right, that he should have known that they know. So maybe he was part of a disinformation campaign. So all I'm saying is, along the way, there's going to be somebody controlling these technologies that are interested in control. They're not interested in optimizing the potential of human beings. You keep talking about IQ, intelligence quotient. Well, what is the emotional quotient for these people? What's the spiritual quotient, okay? Because there's all other types of intelligence. There's other types of ways that we look at things. And believe me, the black world understands this because they probably studied it more than anybody. Okay, they'll poo-poo the spiritual, they'll poo-poo extrasensory perception to you, they'll poo-poo all this stuff to your face, right, which is part of the op. They've studied it more than anybody, and they utilize it. So that's my concern, that these very, very powerful tools, of which you've done a good big service to make people understand how incredibly powerful they could become, are already, to a certain extent, not as powerful as you've described in your book, but still immensely powerful, are in the hands of people that are interested in centralizing wealth and centralizing power, who look at themselves as elites, who look at themselves as people that know better, that have a plan. They have a plan for what humans should be. And, you know, obviously Kurzweil has a plan, the head of R&D for Google. Right, he has a plan and all his transhumanist buddies. And it involves certainly robotics and AI and all this stuff, you know, that you're talking about in spades. They have a plan. They have a plan where basically human beings are no longer. And what I believe is that humans are going to cooperate because they're going to be given treats along the way. You know, and the elites are very surprised about how cheaply humans sell themselves out for treats, just so that they can belong, or for status.
Yeah.
Yeah, or for a little money or something. See? So, I've talked for a while, and, you know, I totally respect what you've done in your book. And obviously, you've been an incredible innovator in this industry that's never really gotten the chance to do as much as he could, but you've obviously, you know, done some pretty remarkable things, and you've pointed the way for a lot of people that may turn out to be very fruitful.
I've not been devoting a lot of energy, mental energy to it the last year or two, This is a complete red herring. I don't know if you want to go into it at all, but I've made about 300 YouTube videos on the theme of masculism, men's lives.
Yes, and I have seen it, and we can get into that at some other time. I don't want to contaminate this with that, because I think you're absolutely right. There is a effort to emasculate men, you know, to obscure differences between genders, and you know, every commercial I see, the guy's the stupidest person in the room, you know. So I think there's a lot to what you're saying. I think that's part of the plan, in a way, to destroy culture, to destroy the state, to have global power structures, you know, and to destroy individualism to a large extent and make it into this gigantic mush, you know, collective mush. Collectivism is dangerous for freedom. But so I've talked a little bit. What is your reaction to what I've said?
Well, you may be right.
It's a scenario that's reasonable.
Yeah, it's quite a possibility. The control may end up just being effectively total. I'm somewhat cynical in the sense that just the technology itself, just to its very nature, as that IQ gap closes, then I see the alarm. You know, people will just, independently of whether they're manipulated or not, we'll just see with their own eyes that.
Wait a minute. You have Hawking that said it before he died. You have Musk. It's making a big deal out of it. What is Musk's solution? We have to become more like AI. We've got to basically hook the machines to our brains so that it won't get an advantage over us.
That's
wild
stuff.
But Musk is saying the same thing.
So
these guys are talking about it. It's in the mainstream now.
Solutions
they have.
I agree. Now, when I wrote, remember, I wrote it 20 years ago.
That's right.
Phase one. I felt very lonely at the time.
So let me ask this last question, because you've been extremely generous with your time. And I hope also you wouldn't mind kind of being a resource if we have questions on AI in the future that
we can call
you up and say, hey, what do you think about this? Or what does this mean? If you were writing this book again today, is there anything that you would change about the fundamental thesis or any of the primary aspects of this book?
I think the fundamental thesis that these artifacts are coming, I don't think I'd change that. I think that's almost obvious. The fact that it's now mainstream shows that most people accept, you know, that these godlike machines are coming. And I think that's generally accepted. What I would change would be, I'd probably add another chapter or two about the more recent phases. You know, talk about phase two and all the organizations that are pushing it, and phase three that's now got into the media. And I mean, you in a sense, are phase three, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, this conversation is partly. And phase four is now starting. Have you heard of Professor Tegg Mark of MIT, the theoretical physics professor? He gets in the media a lot.
Yep.
He's organized a group and went to the United Nations and had a kind of Senate hearing, you know, the equivalent, saying, you know, humanity has to have a kind of moratorium on this stuff because it's just so important, and we're only going to get one shot at it, because if we create a massively intelligent machine and then it just takes off and takes over and does us real damage, well, then it's too late. So we need to be thinking about it before it gets built, you know, this sort of stuff. So this is politics. This is phase four now starting. So, you know, all this is new relative to the book that was written 20 years ago. So.
Yeah, but you seem to be right on target.
Yeah, I guess.
So
I just hope I'm wrong about phase five. But I just do not see a way out. I don't see a way out. Like, do you?
Well, the way out is asymmetrical, and the way out is an awareness, a consciousness that is not measured by IQ. It's an awareness that goes to the very foundation of what humans are and what life's about. And we've got to anchor ourselves in that as a way out. Because
how would that, you know, whatever qualities you want, them and the machines could potentially be vastly superior on whatever the criteria you're choosing. So how would you avoid that problem?
That's what you and I disagree on, because I do not believe that life, all of life, can be digitized. Life on this planet can be digitized. Life in the galaxy can be digitized. But there will be a whole component of life and the potential that's in life that will be absolutely destroyed. And I see all these technologies, because they are so powerful computationally, and all the features and all the things they can do and how fast they can do it and the whiz-bang and everything else, as tremendously impoverishing in another way. So with every technology, there is, you know, great promise and there's great danger. People are celebrating the internet, you know, because it brings the world of knowledge. With a Google search engine, it's astonishing what you can search and get in a fraction of a second. Astonishing. It is the greatest surveillance tool ever invented, if you could invent one. It's the most invasive tool on everybody's freedom. But not only that, and then they're using it. They're using it to come up with brain profiles of people, you know, psychological profiles, behavioral profiles of people that are on the keyboards. And now I can distinguish who's there just by the way that they're doing the keyboard. And so you're going to, at some point, you have to understand what the consequences are of embracing these technologies. And then you've got to make a very simple choice. Are you going to be a free human being, or are you going to be a slave? Because that's where this is leading. And it's a fundamental question that humanity has always faced. And I don't care if it's a slavery that comes through religion, comes through political systems, or anything else. That's the fundamental question that faces humanity. Do you want to live a free and inspired life, which is the mission of Solari, as defined by Catherine Austin Fitz, or do you want to be a slave? And that's what you've helped elucidate. The incredible dangers of, you know, you've expressed it through war, which is a very powerful form of slavery, you know, and force. Are we going to be a race, a species of force, or are we going to be a species of creative thought? And I just believe that there's all kinds of, I mean, I know the way that I solve problems through intuition and many, many other ways, and how you put things together and you have a sense and a gut feel and all the neurons that are in your digestive tract and all this stuff. We don't have any sense at all about how the simplest systems on this planet work from a systems perspective. We have no idea. You take a look at vaccination science, anything. It's primitive. But yet we have the audacity to think that we're going to build this, you know, super intelligence shit, you know, that's going to solve all of our problems. Why don't you first get an understanding of how soil works? Okay? We have a very, very limited. Why don't you get an understanding of what water really is? And the astonishing capabilities, you know, that water has in terms of even memory. Right? Is it just by chance that is the main substance that this planet runs on? And on and on. Look at any living system. Okay? But we're going to go geoengineer climate and then blame it on climate change. Okay? Because of CO2, while we spent for the last 20 years, we've been chemtrailing the entire globe and using HAARP to change weather. Now, we're finding out about this stuff. People have been talking about it for 20 years. But now, finally, it's obviously totally clear. There's huge amounts of evidence now to know that. Okay? So what else have we been geoengineering and screwing up that requires, you know, a solution from the engineers that they engineered in the first place so that they could get more of us? So that's how I believe Catherine feels the same way. That's how we look at the fundamental problem. And so the biggest question I have is, just because you can do it, should you?
Yeah, indeed. indeed.
And I think now these guys, like at MIT, like this guy at MIT, he's asking finally the same question, right?
Tick mark.
Just because you can, should you?
But are there times when you look at the stars, do you ever feel that you're a cosmist? Like they're bigger things?
Of course there's bigger things, and that's why I want to have the opportunity as a human being to experience it. Not as a cyborg, not as a AI-dominated creature. As a human being. Because our potential is beyond, way beyond what we've been, what it's been described as. It's not described by IQ. It's not described by how many pounds you can lift, you know, deadlift. It's not described by how much money you got. It's not, there's a whole other way that we connect with the universe if we're allowed to, if you develop the skill to do it. That is what's most fascinating to me. And I don't feel puny when I look at the universe that has, you know, supposedly now 2 trillion galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars in each one. With, you know, not every star will have a planetary system, but there's plenty of them. Okay? So there absolutely is other life in the universe. Is there other human life? Who knows? Are we an engineered planet? You know, there's arguments for that. How did the moon end up being the way that it is? And this, you know, and all the things that are remarkable about the moon just being where it is and how it operates, you know, without it, you wouldn't have life on this planet. Is that basically an artificial satellite that was put here by, you know, a greater intelligence? Are we basically an experiment? Has there been intervention in our genetics through the ages, through something else? Are we a subsidiary of a larger galactic business, you know, that is AI run? You know, the grays that everybody talks about, are they basically a merge of biology and AI that's controlled by a much smarter thing? So, yeah, I'm open to all this.
My suspicion is the laws of physics themselves are engineered. I learned so much math and physics now. I'm deeply, deeply suspicious that the laws of physics have been engineered, that because they're so mathematical.
And they're also so precise. And you need that precision in order to have life. Right. So maybe the entire universe as we know it. But, okay, so then there's parallel universes, and then there's whatever there is, okay? So none of that scares me, because I'm secure in being a human and knowing what that potential is. And I feel a connectivity to something out there. I don't feel that I'm just planet-bound in terms of mind. And in terms of what people describe as spiritual, I don't use that term very much. But I respect what they say, because we don't have another term to describe a lot of this stuff. So we have connectivity that is non-digital, it's non-wireless, it's non-5G, because all that stuff interferes with the connectedness that we have. Right? It interferes with Schumann resonances. It interferes with some of the foundational electromagnetic stuff that promotes life. And I don't think that's a coincidence. Okay? I think that's engineered. I think it's engineered for control. I don't want to be controlled by the people that are in control. I want to be free. You want to be free. Fundamentally, that's what's driving you. Because you look at that as the ultimate infinite freedom, to have an infinite intelligence that's capable of communicating with the universe in a totally unbelievably incomprehensible, profound way that's yet to be understood, that maybe can only be understood by Artelix. And that's why I asked you the question, can an Artelix be irrational and illogical? Well, that's interesting, because humans can. And, you know, maybe Dostoevsky has something to teach us about that. And we look at that as, you know, always bad, is it? Because how many things have been described as irrational, you know, that ended up being very powerful, like intuition, intuitions are rational to a scientist, right? Until they come up with some model for it that fits in with some math or physics or something else. But it was there before you figured out your math and physics, and what makes you think that your math and physics describes what that is? No, your math and physics describes a mathematical and physical explanation of what it is. See? It's self-limiting. Just like the laws of thermodynamics, you know? These are laws that human beings basically figured out by doing pressure tests and temperature tests in a closed container on the planet Earth, and this is what's going to basically rule. It's a law that humans came up with, the entire universe. How's that for arrogance?
Or universality.
Right? Yeah, but ever come up with anything that that contradicts the laws, the three laws of thermodynamics, and a physicist would tell you it's impossible because it violates the laws of thermodynamics. Of course, it may not violate it on a universal scale. He doesn't even know that. But it's just very interesting. We come up with these laws for the universe by doing these incredibly, you know, primitive experiments. And then we go, we're so smart because we figured out the speed of light, you know, which is a constant, which, of course, isn't a constant. But nobody looks at the anomalies in the speed of light and goes, hey, you guys talked about the speed of light being a constant, and it's always this, and it's the same everywhere. And that's the foundation for all of our physics, you know, the general relativity and everything. But it's not. It varies in speed. But what I would say is this, that there is a push towards productivity, and middle management is being displaced. Now, by middle management, I mean guys like John Gotti. You know, when the CIA finally has their act together when it comes to drugs and assassinations, and you have AI and other things that can basically target people incredibly more efficiently than the way Catherine was targeted 15 years ago by the government and 16 different agencies that cost the taxpayers $45 million and cost her probably $10 million, never mind 30,000 hours of her time. You know, you can do that now much more efficiently. So you don't need a lot of these other people in the middle. And people think that they are, you know, it couldn't happen to me. But I see huge swaths of people that are not needed anymore by the machine.
Mm.
Okay? And that's a major problem for the Earth. And that's the other reason why there's experiments now in you know, assured income, like they're doing up in Norway and so on. Mm. You know, not only because so much money has been stolen, but, and, you know, pension funds are targets, and Social Security, basically, that money's been used. There is a bond there that represents the goodwill and faith of the United States. They took the cash to run the government with, you know, so there is huge amounts of resources that have been concentrated, and there is an increasing need because of technology, or lack of need, for a lot of jobs that are being done by people right now. So, you know, if you get enough people on enough drugs, and when you take a look, you should research sometimes how much drugs people are taking these days. I'm talking about pharmaceuticals, you know, and even at a very early age. And you get enough GMOs in their diet, and you get enough autistic kids because of vaccines and other things, and you put enough blacks in jail so they're not a problem, you know, and you get enough alcoholism going on within the Native American people, which has one of the hugest suicide rates, and you get farmers to kill themselves. Now, farmers, the highest suicide rate is among farmers, and the highest suicide rate is also of states in the United States is in Montana, my state. So I guess if you're a farmer in Montana, you're in trouble. You know, you get enough of basically the population debilitated, they're not going to be able to fight. You're taking the fight out of the resistance to a large extent. and with incredible amounts of, just think about the amounts of scenarios you can run in the supercomputers we have now. You were in Utah, you know, they got that $2 billion data center that the NSA built just to collect all the data in the world and keep collecting it for however they want to use it in the future, however they want AI to look at it. Just think about the amount of scenarios that have been run by the people that with these computers whose job it is, and they get paid in these think tanks to do scenarios. Everything has been scenarioed. So I look at a level of control that is much beyond what most people understand exists. They still think to a large extent that they, you know, their vote counts, that their representative is actually representing their interests, you know, that the President of the United States has real power. You know, we're living in this whole state of illusion about where the power, where the money, where the decisions, where the technology is being controlled from and how robust it is. So I think we're much further along on this AI thing than even you would think we are. Now, it may not be the massively intelligent Artelect that you're talking about, but it has the ability to affect human behavior across the globe. And we've got the connectivity through our cell phones, through our wireless networks, through all these other things that are being put, through the astonishing amounts of satellites that are being put up, you know, hundreds at a time now. These little softball-sized satellites that could do the work of, you know, of gigantic satellites 20 years ago. It's a prison planet. And to me, Catherine is one of the most important people in terms of expressing how our freedom and how our ability to live a free and inspired life is in jeopardy.
How did you two meet?
We met because I heard her on the internet do a speech. I contacted her because she was going to be somewhere. I was busy at the time. I couldn't be there. So I said to her, can I pay you to record it, video it, because it'll be cheaper than me going anyways, and then I have the, you know, the possibility to listen to you because I'm enjoying very much what you're saying. She said, that's a good idea. And then I gave her the money to do that. And then she used that to, you know, as a video that she used on her site. And then, you know, she said, well, who is this guy that's asking this? So she wanted to know more about me. And she ended up actually within a relatively short period of time coming up for 9 months to Montana. And we, you know, she taught me about the real deal. Now, I already was pretty deep into it, but she really perfected my models. And today we, you know, communicate very regularly, and she has it figured out as well as anybody that I know. And basically because she understands the money, she always goes back to the money, and it's got to make sense in terms of the money. And that has worked very well for her in terms of concentrating on money and money flows and psychology around.